Good morning. Welcome to this Thursday edition of the Roundtable and the Roundtable panel. It's the 29th of September. Listening to Darling Side, who will be playing the Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs tomorrow evening, presented by Cafe Lena. And you can find out more going to cafelena.com. Don't forget two F's. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. And it's so nice to have you here. We have a lot to talk about. We'll get to it. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And that's pretty much all you have to do. Keep your letters short and to the point, and that way we'll be able to get to as many as we possibly can. Yesterday, oh, what were we talking about, Alan? We were talking about... We had a topic that we were talking about the funding for loan forgiveness, student loan forgiveness.
Right.
And my God, the letters we got. We just got inundated with letters. So, you know, you have days, you have subjects that hit with people and strike a nerve, and then you just are awash in letters. So we can get to as many as possible if you keep them short and to the point.
Were you looking at me because I'm the only one in this room that still is paying off my student loans?
No, I think we established it yesterday that pretty much anyone under the age of 70 was still paying off their student loans. But good morning, welcome, and we are very happy that you are here. We're happy that Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. I didn't have any. I went to City University to Hunter, and then I had a couple of scholarships. So I didn't have any money that I owed anybody when I got out. Put another way, aren't I terrific?
We go to Mark Whitman, who is an investment banker on Wall Street, knows a thing or two about money. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. I when I got out of business school, I termed myself a walking LBO, or leverage buyout, because I owed a substantial amount of money to NYU and those who had lent me money when I got out. Fortunately, I don't think I owe them any at this juncture.
Yeah, but do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and think maybe you do?
No, I do have the dream about math tests that I miss still, but I don't have any student loan dreams or nightmares.
That dream is just so ubiquitous with everyone, isn't it? It's a or some variation of it. Malia Dumont is here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. My student loans are also from grad school. I'm glad, like, I got a lot of financial aid from Bard as an undergrad. But then, you know, it's strange. Harvard, with its $4 billion endowment, didn't have as much money to give me for grad school as Bard did for undergrad. So
that's why they have it.
I get, they're holding on to it. Yeah. So, can I make a quick PSA on another
topic?
So, for those who aren't able to make it to Saratoga Springs for the wonderful concert of the lovely music we are listening to, tomorrow night in Troy, there's an event called Troy Night Out. I've never been to Troy, but I'm going to this event tomorrow night because one of the things going on there is there's going to be an exhibition opening at the Arts Center of the Capital Region, whose CEO is a Bard alum. And so she's going to be hosting a bunch of Bardians and anyone else who wants to show up for the opening of a wonderful new photography exhibition. And I think there are a lot of other things going on in Troy tomorrow night.
Yeah, Troy Night Out is always a terrific evening. And especially this time of year, you just walk the streets as it's comfortable and lovely. And I like your use of the word Bardian.
Me too.
Yeah.
Oh. I noticed that as well. I thought that was something that sat in a tree at night.
I mean, it's, yes.
Hoot. We also welcome Fran Berman to the program. Speaking of Harvard, research professor and Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Good morning, Fran Berman.
Good morning. How are you?
We are doing well. Thank you very much for being with us. It's very nice to have you on the program, as always.
I have to say that my own student loan story is that I did not have them, but that's because the tuition at the University of California was low enough that I could, you know, get a math degree and be a waitress at the same time.
And that just doesn't really happen anymore, does it?
Sad to say, it really, well, it does, but it doesn't. Tuition is much higher at all schools, all public schools.
Well, I wish you had waited on me when you were a waitress at that time. That would have been great. I'm sure you were a great waitress. But I thank you for
being... I was fun, just saying.
I thank you for being here, and it's good to have you aboard. Let's go to what is making news in our region. And beyond, of course, the big story is obviously Florida. The big story is the hurricane that slammed the Gulf Coast yesterday. We are still, as the sun is up and things are starting to become a little bit clearer as to the extent of the damage. We know that millions are without power in Florida. Damaging winds, threat of flooding remain as this weather system, now a tropical storm, moves north. The causeway to Sanibel Island in southwest Florida was severely damaged by Hurricane Ian. Florida has released a website for Ian recovery volunteers. They're looking for people to help in this recovery effort. Again, when I say millions, 2.5 million people without power, and the rescue of the stranded is really what is top of the agenda today, and volunteers are completely overwhelmed. There, one volunteer saying there's just only so much we can do, that one person can do it at one time. And it is a really devastating storm. If you look at the maps of it, and you see it work its way across the state, it is really incredible, because obviously Florida is a big state, and it pretty much covers most of Florida, going right into the center of it. President Biden on Thursday approved a major disaster declaration for Ian in Florida. As the National Hurricane Center said, Ian is producing catastrophic flooding over east and central parts of the state. The storm is also projected to bring potentially life-threatening floods, storm surge, and winds to parts of Florida, Georgia, and North and South Carolina as it makes its way toward the northeast northeast Florida, and then approaches the South Carolina coast on Friday. The center downgraded Ian from a Category 1 hurricane early this morning. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said late Wednesday that while the storm surge was likely to have peaked, there is going to be damage throughout the entire state. So what to know? The National Hurricane Center said that Ian, which is heading toward Florida's northeast with maximum sustained winds of about 65 miles an hour, is expected to further weaken Friday night and into Saturday, and may intensify at times, and could be near hurricane strength on Friday when it approaches South Carolina. Ian battered parts of Florida's western coast, tearing down trees and power lines and causing dangerous storm surges in parts of the state. Authorities in Fort Myers, which was badly hit, said late Wednesday that parts of the city were under 3 to 4 feet of water. To the south in Naples, half of the streets, quote, are not passable due to high water. Hurricane warnings that were in effect for parts of Florida east and west coast were changed early Thursday to tropical storm warnings. Several airports across the state suspended commercial operations and have canceled flights. So there's the update of where we are at this particular time and a storm that moved through the state very, very quickly.
You know, Joe, I keep wondering. And, you know, my mom and dad, they're passed, of course, now, but they lived in Florida, and they lived in a place that, you know, one could look out on the ocean and see the storms and relate to it. So I have a feeling an awful lot of people in our listening area are thinking about their folks. They're thinking about being in Florida when they were and what it means to them. I think we can all relate to it.
There's certainly no shortage of knowing people, right, in Florida and who have homes there, and many of even people I know.
Yeah, my best friend lives in Tampa, actually. Yeah. So I've been really worried. The storm passed south of there, so she wasn't hit directly, but she had to leave her apartment because she was under mandatory evacuation order, and is staying with someone about an hour outside of Tampa now, and they haven't lost electricity where they are, but they're watching what's happening down at Fort Myer, and it's just a total tragedy there. A lot of deaths and people unable to get what they need right now. But a lot of National Guard troops are coming in. Other states are sending Guard troops in, and I know the Red Cross has set up an enormous operation.
This is a precarious moment because you're becoming aware of the devastation, and yet the storm hasn't fully moved through yet.
Yeah.
And you still have to say, okay, well, there's going to be more.
Right.
And more damage done. Mark?
I have a mother-in-law who's in Sarasota, so right by the Sanibel area where you – well, you mm-hmm. talk about the Sanibel mm-hmm. Causeway, but
yes.
Right in that area. Fortunately, they said there was a lot of landscaping that was removed, but everybody's okay, and the property is otherwise okay. I did think from a political standpoint, you'd send something out, and Ron DeSantis was saying, well, when there are lives at stake, there are no politics. And they talked about how he and the president were getting along. And at first when I read that, I thought to myself, well, there's no real political angle here, is there? And then I thought about it a little more, and
yeah,
I thought, well, wait a minute here, Governor DeSantis. And it's unfair to blame him entirely for this, but there are lives at stake every day with respect to immigration. And for some reason, you and the president can't seem to reach across any aisle. As a matter of fact, you're interested in creating stunts as opposed to solutions. So it is an interesting question you have to ask yourself. What is it about facing Mother Nature that causes us to ally with one another, but when we face other political problems, even when lives are at stake, we can't do the same?
No, it's a great point, but we do know that when people need each other, they reach out. So presidents of one party and people in other parties reach out to each other. But it is rather disgusting that we can't do more of it when we really need it.
Fran Berman.
Something happened.
I think the storm... The storm is impacting your...
and the wind, and it's, it's fine.
Hey, Fran.
But it's...
We're having trouble hearing from you. You're digitized and dropping in and out. So I'm gonna take you offline for a second, and then we'll let the engineers work on this for a minute or two and try to have you reconnect, and hopefully we can take care of that problem so we can hear from you. Those internet lines in Massachusetts. I don't know in Amherst. We'll hopefully get Fran back on in just a few moments. I'd like to go back to the political nature of this. Yeah, it seemed. I just thought even the coverage of that is, you would hope that that's just what you would expect.
Obvious. Somebody made the point earlier, Joe, sorry for interrupting, that there's a noticeable difference in the apprehension we have about what's happening in Florida now and what happened in Puerto Rico. In other words, we're over-covering Florida, theoretically. I don't think it is, but we are paying a lot of attention to Florida that maybe we didn't pay in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and Florida is, in this particular case, it is a storm that hasn't, a storm of this magnitude. It's been a while. I forget. I read what it was.
Decades.
That it's a storm that has been this catastrophic to the state. And also usually the storms when they come, the ones that have done the most damage have come in through the east coast of Florida and banged into the east coast anywhere from Miami to Jacksonville, where this one made its way into the Gulf Coast. And I know I shouldn't be petty, but the fact that Don Lemon last night kept on calling Orlando part of the Gulf Coast was making me crazy.
We should make it clear that Joe is no Don Lemon.
But But still, of coming in through the Gulf Coast and, as you said, the Sanibel and Fort Myers area. And there is a basically a little bay there of where we talked about this yesterday, but the storm went in and sort of just went popping around like a pinball. Because of the land, it took a direct hit to that bay, and then went across the state. And as Malia said, was originally headed toward Tampa, but did track pretty far south of Tampa, and then headed over into Orlando, and now out to sea. Fran, you're back.
Joe, I think I'm back on. I hope you guys can hear me. Yeah, what I was going to say is two things. Number one, it's going pretty slowly, so it has a lot of water to dump, and that water just sits there, and so that's why you see these sort of horrendous levels of water that are, you know, flooding cars and homes and all of that kind of stuff. Actually, I had three things. The second thing was
Can I put you on hold for the second and third? Can I put you on hold for the second, third thing? We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back for two and three. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable again, playing Darlingside this morning, playing at UPH in Saratoga Springs. Tomorrow you can find out more by going to Cafe Lena. .org, C-A-F-F-E, Lena.org. All right, let's go to the other two points that Fran was going to make. Fran, I believe we've changed your mode of communication.
You have. The technologist is having technology problems this morning, so it must be just dessert somehow or another.
Well, let me just say that the old technology, the phone, you sound great.
Yeah.
So we'll go with that today, but go ahead.
All right. We'll go with you guys are very kind not to have me come across the Berkshires like Alan does very early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess just my other two points were number one, just personal, is I was down in the Florida Keys with a friend of mine last spring for a little vacay. Kayaking through the mangroves was really wonderful. And if you think about these keys, you know, they're just islands connected by roads. And those roads are inundated, so they're now really isolated. And if you think about whatever damage there might be to these roads that connect them and all of that, it's certainly the geography of Florida certainly exacerbates things. So, you know, another thing to be concerned about. I also wanted to kind of follow up on that comment about the political piece of it, because thinking about DeSantis' reaction, which of course is a reasonable reaction, you have got to work with the national folks because this is a problem for everyone. It's a problem for people in Florida. We're part of a country. That country thinks about emergency services wherever the problems happen. And he's kind of gone temporarily from collaborator to, you know, from bully to collaborator. And it got me thinking about, why does crisis bring out the best in us? I started thinking about my own experience on September 11th when I was living in San Diego and stuck in Washington, D.C., and ending up driving across the U.S. with some other people because there was no way to get a flight out. Mm-hmm. And the kindness and generosity of everyone during that time was amazing. And, you know, you think in times like this, people want to give. They send money. They send supplies. They get along with each other. Why is it that we're this way in crisis and we're not this way every day?
Because we have the memory of fleas.
I've really been thinking about that.
We were in the Coliseum at the moment that all of this was happening, and they put up a sign on the door that basically said how much they were feeling for the United States and the Americans. And Roselle went in and asked if she could have it. And there it sits in our downstairs bathroom to this day.
Yeah, it was such a, you know, intense time. But that intensity brought out the best in us, and I'm happy it brings out, you know, whatever there could, whatever good there is in DeSantis. But, you know, could we just have a little of that every day?
No.
No.
I mean, don't you think it has the same thing to do with, I mean, we saw this just hours after the insurrection at the Capitol. There were people that are concerned, and then, you know, everybody seems to come together, and you got Lindsey Graham saying, you know, I've had enough, and we're going to move on, and then by, you know, Leader McCarthy, and then the next morning, boom, everything had changed. And the same thing happens in our history, where we say, well, this is what we need to do now, and then you turn around and say, well, let's, you know, that was obviously a mistake, so let's do it again. How's that? It just seems to be who we are, unfortunately.
It makes me happy and sad at the very same time, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, it is, you know, it's quite a story, and one that I think, as these stories go, as probably, and I think this is also to your point, Fran, that when people actually will need the most, as they are really struggling to rebuild and struggling to move back into their homes and struggling to recreate their communities, by that time, anyone outside of Florida has probably moved on and isn't as engaged in what is happening as they are now.
Although everybody has a relative in Florida, period.
I don't have relatives in Florida.
What's the matter with you?
Many things, Alan. Many things.
Well, all right. Let's go to the letters this morning and see what's on people's mind. Please mention Congressman DeSantis' vote against aid for New York and New Jersey after Superstorm Sandy. So mentioned. Similar letter from Diane: when Hurricane Sandy decimated New Jersey and New York, then Congressman DeSantis voted against aid for us. I don't know what is the political motivation of voting against aid for states in need? This sort of goes against what you were just saying.
I think there has to be a proof to some of the followers of some politicians the people that they're following are appropriately mean to the people out of office.
I mean, it just, you know, you think when you see enough people clutching their chimneys and waiting for boats to come that maybe that's, you know, pretty good proof that they need help, right?
Well, there's always somebody who speaks up and says this is proof that God is unhappy with a particular group.
At the time they did, and if you remember, Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell were also involved in installing that aid. They did it under the guise of fiscal responsibility, which is a guise Republicans, unfortunately, often use for regrettable behavior. And I think that they were just trying to show their constituents that they could be mean. And, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. When Kentucky was beset by storms and they needed help, their tune changed very quickly.
Then Debbie says, what about Governor DeSantis' response to the COVID emergency? That was also an emergency and a health crisis that affected all of us. We saw none of this kinder side of him then. Seems like a fair point.
That's so true.
Make.
You know, the comment is that people are dying, but people are dying with COVID too.
Yes.
So, you know, it's, you know, choose your poison, I guess. That's a terrible metaphor, but.
Let's not also overstate what DeSantis is doing. He's not being kind. It's his job to support. Right. I mean, you know, it's not like he suddenly woke up and it's like, oh, I'm going to be nice to my constituents today. This is his job. And so, I mean, he can still be a mean SOB and you know, and do his job.
Of course,
I don't think he's changed in
of
his
course
nature.
Of course, it occurs to you that the guy wants to be president of the United States, right?
Well, yeah, and not being the guy's personal therapist, my conjecture, no fact here, is that, you know, he's just being political. You know, he's trying to look like the good guy so he can get elected or whatever. So, yeah, but I like the outcome. The outcome is some collaboration, which is important.
We're getting a lot of letters basically making the same point about
DeSantis's vote on Hurricane Sandy. So I think we've covered that. So you can hold those letters. Amy said, I wish lives lost in crisis would have applied to COVID. Aren't viral outbreaks a natural disaster as well? Natural disasters bring out collaboration because they are more visible and tangible to people. It's too bad lives lost only sort of matter sometimes. And expanding on the previous letter, this one going to Alan's point about Florida and Puerto Rico. It is terrible, writes Mike, the destruction that is occurring in Florida, but the state was fortunate to have enormous resources moved into place before the storm so that rescues and the reconstruction of essential infrastructure could begin immediately. I don't remember this type of mobilization of resources happening pre-storm in Puerto Rico. Additionally, Puerto Rico is far more in need than Florida. It is just as worthy. So why that disparity? We go to Anna, and the subject line is pessimist. I was born with the pessimism gene. It wouldn't surprise me if when the current acute hurricane situation is passed that DeSantis complains about the government and Biden's response. Seems like could be a fair bet. Tom says, wait and listen. I've turned off the radio discussing that you cannot suspend political consequences, which are all guesses, for 1 hour or two while many are dying.
Wait. You didn't turn off the radio because you just wrote to the radio and you're listening right now. Gotcha!
I don't know how we...
What?
Working out the political consequences part, but well, okay. 9/11, the sign and support, man, and so much. Okay. Okay. I bet you more. I bet you there are more COVID deaths in Florida than from Ian. That is from M.
Can we talk for a little bit about? And get your all you letter writers, get ready. I think this issue about DeSantis and COVID, I tell you, before I sort of reread what's out there about his work during the COVID crisis, I would have told you he got an F. I do think, and other news outlets, including The Economist, agree that if you look at some of the big calls he made about opening schools earlier, he probably actually got it right. He did better in terms of healthcare facilities for the aged than some of the media darlings like Cuomo did. Now, he was helped out by the fact that when he said there's no mask mandate statewide, most of the localities basically sort of covered for him and put one in place. And if you look at the death rates in Florida, last figures I could look at, Florida was... towards the middle of the pack, maybe on the better side. Now, it's an outdoor state largely, so you can claim that they had a natural advantage there. But I just think I would challenge people. There are lots of things to hate about lots of people and lots of policies. But once the dust has settled on some of these issues, I do think it behooves us to take a second look and maybe a better appraisal of what happened. And we'll probably talk about this later, but if you look at what's happening in the United Kingdom with them trying to sort of reuse Reaganomics, they suffer from the fact that they didn't look at the historical context of why arguably it worked, and they step into a pothole all over again because they didn't take a cold, sort of detached look at history. And I think DeSantis's handling of the COVID pandemic or the depths of it are far more nuanced than many people have decided.
All right. With that, we'll wait for those letters to come in. And in the meantime, we'll take a break. We welcome you and your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. How it rambles round the moon. The let go of blue. Nothing is forever. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Alan Shartok, Mark Whitman, Malia Dumont, and Fran Berman. And we will also go to your letters, back to your letters here. We welcome them, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I have no relatives in Florida either. I think the question about empathy being short-lived in this country and probably most of the world is that when bad things happen, most people react with empathy, though this is variable by factors of racism, etc. But there are always a few people who see everything through the lens of whether it's an opportunity for them to profit or increase their power. The problem is that people seeking power tend to end up in power, and that's why we have the Ron DeSantis's of the world as well as the Trumps. DeSantis only cares about helping the people of Florida in the crisis and getting all the federal help he can because he knows if he botches it, he loses power. He doesn't actually care about anyone other than himself. That from Suzanne in Shutesbury. We now go to this from Diane, who says, if I'm not mistaken, didn't DeSantis relieve the person who is keeping tabs on deaths of COVID of her position so the real, quote-unquote, numbers wouldn't be published? Yes, as he is the governor of the state, he has a responsibility, but it is an election year for him. Let's see.
On that point about relieving the person in charge of counting, if you look at numbers including excess deaths, which are calculated outside of the auspices of health departments, you still get the same result in terms of Florida's near the middle of the pack or a little bit better.
And I want to point out, as I tried to before, that DeSantis's name has been prominently mentioned, assuming Trump isn't the candidate, as a potential presidential candidate.
Christine says, population Florida 3.2 million, Florida 22.2 million. Stop looking for controversy where it doesn't exist. All right. That from Christine. Dear panel, was just reading about Trump whining like a crybaby that the media spent the whole weekend talking about the impending hurricane. This man has to go. What kills me is that people in his state were in need, and he has a huge facility that could have housed people in an emergency. When will these people stop giving money to bolster Trump? The very same people that are probably donating like crazy got nothing from him in the hurricane complaints. Maybe Florida will ask him the same way that New York has. What a whiny, miserable crybaby while people are preparing and suffering.
By the way, do we know how Mar-a-Lago has been affected by the hurricane?
We do not. Although I don't
think it's far south.
Far south, yeah. It's pretty far south. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
It's on the other coast.
It's on the other coast.
It's on the other coast.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Yeah, it's far south from even Orlando, where it went. Let's see. We got this from. This is how to pronounce. The real question, is it pronounced E-N or Ian? I thought it was Ian.
I didn't realize there was more than one way to pronounce it.
Yeah, we have a news director here named Ian, so that's obviously the way to do it.
Yes. Richie says it's time for a new host of the Roundtable. Joe has lost his fastball. I would just like to say, I don't think
a ridiculous letter.
I would just like to say to the letter writer, I swear to you, I never had a fastball.
No.
Never, ever, ever, ever had a fastball.
No, that's a no.
It is a no, Fran. And I go around all over the place, and everybody tells me how they love the show and they love what Joe does with it.
Does the writer have a specific complaint? In what way have you not shown a fastball this morning?
It just says, stay home and be a listener.
Sweet.
No. That's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's all right. They have their right.
Can we fire listeners, Joe?
I just got a kick out of the fastball part. Duffy said, good morning, panel. How about talking about the reason that are more and more frequent powerful storms than historically expected rather than the politics of climate deniers? Well, that's a great point, obviously. There are the climate elements. We did talk about it yesterday to some length about the warm waters that churn in both the Gulf and the Atlantic Ocean and how the impact that that has had. So we have talked about it. But you're right. I think generally in the conversation it should be something that we talk about more. Mark, you're shaking your head.
I actually take exception when the media tries to make any one particular event about climate change. I actually think it undermines the argument because I don't think there's a way to prove that any one event is part of climate change. I do think you can draw the conclusion that we as humans have sullied and continue to sully our environment at an unacceptable rate, and the consequences will be dire if we don't figure it out. But saying that any one given storm or any one given record is a result of climate change, I think, is folly and undermines a much better, more solid argument.
I think a related point is how the destruction of the environment actually makes the consequences of the storm worse as well.
Right.
So, to a certain extent, Sanibel Island, which sort of got hit directly, is a little bit lucky that a big part of the island is a beautiful wildlife refuge. So that sort of absorbs some of the natural fury of the storm. The destruction of mangrove swamps, makes the impact of the storm stronger when it does hit land. And as Fran pointed out, the storm is dumping a ton of water, and a lot of that water is going to stay around longer because there are less places for it to go because the environment has been destroyed. We've seen that a lot more in Louisiana because of the Mississippi Delta is a natural sort of storm absorber. There's less of that around Florida, but even the little that there was has been sort of systematically reduced.
Good morning from Joel. Not one word about the devastation in Cuba. Is that because it's a communist country? Well, I know we covered Cuba. I mean, the story today obviously is Florida and not Cuba, but right? But I know the devastation and what had happened in Cuba was, as far as the communist country, I mean, there is a limit of information, but there's that.
I mean, there are a lot of disasters around the world that we're not covering right now.
Let's see. We got this from Dave, who says, a broken clock is right twice a day. Doesn't make DeSantis' approach nuanced. He went out of his way to hire a Surgeon General COVID denier. That from Dave. We also go to John, who writes, Florida is third worst in number of deaths in the U.S., not the middle of the pack, with 81,000 plus deaths, 47 just yesterday. That is the COVID deaths, third highest. There's a difference between...
Isn't it the third largest state? You have to look at the rates when you look at deaths.
Yes. That's a great point, yes. Theodore writes, there is a difference between our community and those in the South. We remember that DeSantis is a troll, but we still support aid to people in Florida, even though they didn't support us. DeSantis and Cruz aren't acting in a vacuum. Their constituents likely supported them. What is wrong with people in the South?
By the way, did Ted Cruz go to Cancun, or wasn't it the disaster wasn't close enough to his state to merit that response?
Yeah,
I was curious.
Cancun,
that's right.
I think.
Yeah. That's fair to say. Let's see. We have about a minute and a half, so we'll get to a few more letters here. Oh, please. Everything Ron DeSantis does is a political calculation to it. Even his seeming humanity at this time. The man is Trump's brother by another mother. We go to Orland, who says, of course the numbers are low in Florida. When you falsify data, that happens. Mr. Hypocrisy, Ron DeSantis, there is nothing compassionate and cooperative about DeSantis. He needs the federal help now, so of course he's going to make nice. My bet is that he will take all credit for anything good that comes to his state and maybe find something to blame on the president and Democrats. That from Ruth. One more, and then we'll take a break here. And let's see. James writes, Governor DeSantis better be careful not to shake hands or even hug President Biden. It could end his political career, much like it did when Governor Christie hugged President Obama after Hurricane Sandy. Is this something we said? No.
I have a very naive question for you.
Oh, go ahead.
Joe, I have a very naive question for you.
Yeah.
Why do you have to be there to show you care? All of these crazy news people who, you know, are reporting from while they're being knocked around by high winds. I don't get it. I don't get why they need to do that to report the news. Am I missing something?
Well, I mean,
Biden have to go down there to be helpful?
I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think it is expected of if there is mass devastation that the president, the governor, the senators would, survey the damage and go down and offer relief. I think that is a political tradition.
And if he doesn't, he'll be accused of being callous and not caring.
Oh, yeah. CNC also, George Bush did want to disturb things in New Orleans. And so he did a flyover. Just check out how that worked for him politically. And you've got the answer to your question.
Well,
yeah, I know the answer is political, but the real answer is it shouldn't matter to show you care. But I understand that. I know it's a naive question.
No, I think your other point though is why do you need 27 reporters that are wet and being blown on?
Wet with electronic equipment.
Yes.
Are you crazy?
Yeah. Well, And then telling people that they're absolute idiots if they go outside. That's the other thing I like.
Right.
And when they're and the one dude there who's just like holding on to the pole so he doesn't blow away. I don't know. I mean, that's a very good point. I think we could probably care if we just had a picture out the window. I agree with you, Fran, but, it's all television.
I understand this is not reality, but in Fran's kinder, gentler world, it makes no sense.
We are radio people, so we don't know the answers to those questions. We can make it sound like a storm, a theater of the mind, and have it go away. All right. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. ORG. We'll be right back after this. There's a broken clock tower out in the ocean. Only me under the table. Tipping me down like a cradle. Drowning me out with an amen. Heralding heaven in all lands. And everything's fine. We're a long way from the best of the best of times. Long way from the best of times. That sort of sounds like how I'm feeling right now.
Oh, yeah,
that's good.
I'm with you, Joe.
Good morning. Welcome. That's the sound of everything coming to a grinding halt. Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. That's Darling Side. They sound great. They're going to be at UPH, which is Universal Preservation Hall. And when Cafe Lena has events that are too big for the smaller space at Cafe Lena, they have these amazing events at Universal Preservation Hall, which if you've not been to, is a gorgeous, gorgeous facility. It's an old church. And that has been redone, and it's a stunning place to see a concert or any performance. So anyway, you can check them out, cafelena.org, to find out more information about that particular show. Now let's go to other topics. How about that? And we will find out what's on your mind about these issues. I want to panel at WAMC by the way, panel at WAMC.org. Actually, there were a couple of letters that I wanted to get to still about DeSantis. It's not surprising that a political creature so adept at performative cruelty toward black and brown people proves able to muster performative empathy when many of the victims are white. Also, Jane says, I think we all know why it is meaningful when the president, governors, etc., go to a disaster site. It shows caring in a way that words just don't. And the people they interact with appreciate talking with them in person. A president talking about it on TV or radio is just not the same. Let's see. If you can see... If you can see, you can read a photograph. Devastating storms make stunning backdrops, especially for politicians who want to, quote unquote, show their constituents that they indeed care. And we have this letter. New York is the biggest donor state in the U.S. with a negative balance of payments at $22 trillion. For every dollar New York gives the federal government, its residents are only receiving 91 cents back. Can you explain what that means, Mark?
I think what they're saying is on a net basis, we pay more to, we as a state pay more to the federal government than we get back. That's an assertion that I believe. But given the size of the U.S. economy, last time I checked was about $27 trillion. I don't know that balance of payments deficit is perhaps a cumulative calculation. I'm not sure how that came about.
And they're saying that the biggest takers are Virginia, Kentucky, and Florida.
That's I wouldn't doubt it with the first two. Florida, I'm not so sure about, but I think that's generally right, which is the states in the South tend to do better on a net basis in terms of monies paid into the federal government as opposed to those that they get out.
All right, change of subject. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Mark Whitman, you are up. The Bank of England intervenes to stabilize UK finances after the Liz Truss budget. This from the Washington Post. To avert credit crunch and economic fallout, the action by the central bank to keep credit flowing followed an intensely negative reaction in the bond markets to the new prime minister's plan. The Bank of England moved Wednesday to quell a financial market revolt, announcing that it would temporarily buy an unlimited quantity of government bonds to prevent disorderly trading from destabilizing the British economy. Were dysfunction in this market to continue or worsen, there would be a material risk to UK financial stability, the central bank said in a statement. The central bank acted after investors resoundingly rejected Prime Minister Truss's plan to use borrowed money to pay for tax cuts while spending freely to insulate consumers from soaring energy bills after the government unveiled its proposal Friday. Investors fearing it would aggravate inflation that is already near 10% dumped government bonds and the British pound. I was interesting in just the mechanics of this, but the Bank of England can make that decision separate from Parliament and the Prime Minister.
Yeah, you can think of their function a lot like our Fed, although their wall in terms of insulating the Bank of England from politics isn't quite as strong. Alan's taught me that none of these walls are impenetrable when it comes to politics, but the one over in England isn't as strong. So, you know, look, England has suffered from a secular decline in growth for quite some time. And in order to try and spark, as well as, by the way, that they and the rest of Europe, because of their dependence on the rest of the EU's energy policy and their proximity to Russia, have suffered quite a bit more than the U.S. has in terms of energy prices. Their inflation is worse than ours by at least a couple percentage points because of that. The government got the great idea that because they think Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics once worked, they were going to try that. And the answer the markets came up with was to throw up on the plan. There's another term for the another bodily function, but I can't mention it on radio in terms of what the markets did to the plan. And the reason for that was because this current set of circumstances is nothing like when Reaganomics allegedly worked. And by the way, Reaganomics didn't really work. Inflation in this country didn't come down until the Congress raised taxes. The U.S. at the time, as it does now, benefits from the fact that we are the reserve or safety currency in the world. And so even in times of difficulty that we cause, the U.S. becomes a haven, U.S. dollar becomes a haven for people looking for a safe place to put their money. That is not the case with the British pound. I mean, their economy is only roughly one-tenth the size of ours. Additionally, Reaganomics worked in part because of, ironically, well, it didn't work, but things got better in the United States at the same time as we tried Reaganomics for a couple of reasons, including, ironically, that women entered the workforce in great numbers, increased the productive capacity of our economy at the time. There is an argument to be made that there were structural changes in terms of removing barriers to economic activity that Reagan did successfully remove. But the UK, and by the way, Thatcher removed probably more serious barriers at the time when she tried a version of Reaganomics. But those barriers are long gone, and those that remained aren't that significant, and the plan in the UK wasn't going to help. So the markets basically said, look, you're taking on a bunch of debt to give rich people tax breaks and to spend more on insulating your populace against rising energy prices. That probably means you're not as safe a bet in the long run in terms of buying government bonds, the British government bonds. And that did cause some temporary disruption in the marketplace as people were basically being forced to sell because they couldn't find a buyer, as funds were being forced to sell because they couldn't buy a buyer, and the problem sort of snowballed on itself. So the Bank of England did the right thing, which is step in and try and help put order in the market. But ironically, when they do that, they actually inject more money into the economy, more currency into the economy. And as we've learned at this roundtable many times, the number one reason for inflation is too much money in the economy. The other thing that it does, by the way, is the United States, we've effectively, as our dollar becomes stronger, as we raise rates, we're sort of forcing the rest of the world to do the same thing. If they don't, their currency becomes far less attractive, which allows us actually to export our inflation. When what I mean by that is the dollar becomes stronger, it's easier for Americans to go buy goods, say, in the British economy, and those in Britain, instead of buying imports from America, buy internally inside of Britain, which actually makes their inflation worse. So basically, the UK in 2022 is nothing like what it is Reaganomics tried to solve. Reaganomics itself probably definitely wasn't why we solved our economic problems when Reagan tried it. And so the UK, the attempt to sort of reproduce it in the UK has been a failure, and they're going to need to reverse course.
I have a question, Mark. If Britain was still part of the EU, if they hadn't done Brexit, would this have been different, or is this kind of orthogonal to that?
Oh, great question.
No, that's a great question. And it actually highlights a point I probably should have mentioned in the prelude, which is Britain's economic problems have been worsened by their exit from the EU, and the fact that they haven't been able to put in place trade agreements that would have been as favorable to them as those that they would have had inside of the EU. So it helped create the problem that they're trying to solve. And additionally, it exacerbates the fact that when they pick a poor solution, the markets are ever more doubtful about the long-term safety of the UK as opposed to other countries or other places to put your money.
Do we pay too much attention to the UK?
Well, I would argue in this case, they clearly paid far too much attention to us trying to replicate, you know, an old economic policy that worked for the wrong reasons. We pay a lot of attention to the UK. They speak a similar language, right? I mean,
similar,
yeah, not identical. We understand them, and there is some sort of relationship in the family tree Whether or not that's too much, I don't know.
But by the way, Fran, I just want to compliment you on the use of the word orthogonal. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so, what, yeah, I was impressed,
it's
too.
It's not a radio-friendly word.
No, it's a great word. It's a fantastic
sounds
word.
Sounds great.
Yes.
Look it up.
Independently, it's statistically independent.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, one of the reasons to pay attention to the UK in this particular situation is because they are experiencing a worse crisis than other places in Europe. So I'm glad we have Mark here to talk about sort of the mechanics of the economy. But why is Great Britain going through this crisis right now? At its root, it's an energy problem, and the International Monetary Fund released a study earlier this month that said that households in Britain are experiencing deeper impacts from the energy crisis around Europe than any other country in Western Europe. And why is that? I'm sure there's a lot of complicated reasons, but one of them is that there has been a lot less focus on energy efficiency in Britain for whatever reason. You know, I can't do a comparative analysis of, you know, different countries in Western Europe and how they've handled this, but apparently in the UK, their homes are much less energy efficient than you find in a lot of other countries in Western Europe, and so just regular people are being plunged into poverty with the highest rise in fuel prices just this past spring that they've ever experienced.
Mm. There was even a story, actually was in the UK not too long ago, and I read a story about people giving up their lizards. And I thought to myself,
I'm sorry?
People giving up their
How
lizards.
How many people have lizards?
I don't know, but apparently it's so expensive now to keep the heat lamps on that lots of people in Britain have decided that they no longer want to own lizards as pets. I mean, the energy crisis is real over there, and it's going to get worse. Unfortunately, this government...
Yeah, that's what happened to pythons in Florida. I just want to point that out.
Okay. Apparently, this government's response, in 2 weeks, they've managed to mess things up pretty quickly. I can only think what happens over the next month while they're in power.
Wow. You know things have gone to hell when you can't keep the lizards alive. When it comes to the length of this, Mark, and the impact, this is sort of a one-off of the question that Alan asked you. But as your answer was, is that perhaps they pay too much attention to us. Will it have an effect on our economy in any way?
It's funny you say that. Somebody asked that of...
Well, see, I have a fastball.
They asked that of one of the Federal Reserve governors who equivocated on the answer by saying it doesn't help. Which I thought was really...
That's probably true, right? It doesn't help.
Yeah, if I were a professor and that was their quiz answer, I wouldn't give them full credit, frankly. The answer is it doesn't hold that much significance for us in the United States. Also, I don't think, if this were happening in Italy or one of the other members of Europe where the fissures between that country and the EU standing firm with regard to Ukraine were more visible, I would worry about what that meant for support for Ukraine. But in the case of the EU, I don't think that's in doubt. I think they're going to have to solve this, but I don't think they'll leave the coalition in any meaningful way because of this. So the answer is, I do think it's a great occasion to revisit Reaganomics. And despite the fact that Trump gave Arthur Laffer a Freedom Prize after he was done giving one to Limbaugh, it's pretty clear that the Reaganomics didn't work. The things did resolve in our economy, but not because of Reaganomics. I think it's a good occasion to revisit that. But from the standpoint of Americans, I don't think there's that much of an immediate impact, unless you're in London, in which case, by the way, things were a lot cheaper than they were last time I was there.
Right. Yeah. And how is our economy seems to be, or not our economy, but the market seem to be stabilizing from where we were last week?
Yeah, the markets, people came back from the Hamptons and wherever else. The market traders spend their summers, and they got all worried about conditions and realized that things were worse than they had thought before they went away, which I think is a reasonable conclusion. But as I said last time I was on the show, I would keep your hands inside the ride for the time being. I think next month's inflation numbers could be bad. I think they could have potentially political consequences, but we'll see.
Inside the ride, could you explain?
When you get on a ride at the top of the hill, they tell you to keep your hands and arms inside the ride
so you don't lose them
because there's going to be some
extremity.
Right.
There's going to be some excitement potentially here.
I see. So just play it safe.
Play it safe.
Yeah. Keep your hands inside the ride. Remember those? Did you have a carousel growing up, Alan, that had the brass ring?
Yes.
Yeah. And then it had the
grew up in Manhattan. We have everything.
Yeah. Well, and they don't have them anymore. They're all gone. That's the problem. Yeah. And although the Central Park carousel had it for a number of years,
yes.
they had it, and the metal arm would come down, and there would be rings. So you put your child on a carousel, and it spins around, and then you take an inanimate object and put it outside with rings in it and wonder why children were losing limbs left and right. It wasn't good. With that said, it was a lot of fun, and there are places in this country you can still go.
to try to catch the golden ring.
To try to catch the brass ring for a free ride. All right, let's go to some letters, and then when we come back, we'll talk about AI with Fran. I hope you're as fascinated by that story as I am, Fran.
Wow, it's mind-boggling. It really is.
All right, so we'll talk about that. It was sort of top of the heap in the Washington Post yesterday about this idea of just the creation, almost instant creation of images. We'll talk about that in just a second. We'll go to letters in regards to about Reaganomics, but here we go. Regarding Reaganomics in the recent British budget, I often hear them discussed as serious policies meant to help the economy or the common person, but it seems on the face of it that these policies are simply giveaways to the rich. Are they giveaways to the rich, Mark?
They certainly are. And the argument used to be if you gave away enough to the rich, they would spend so much more back in the economy that would benefit. And the answer is that gets an F in terms of its grade.
The conservative speaker, I think that's you, Mark. I don't know if I would label you that way, but that's the way this listener has labeled you.
It's better than the godforsaken investment banker.
The conservative speaker once again tap danced around evidence, giving him an audience of something to reconsider. I don't know how you tap dance around the evidence, but... Okay.
What evidence?
I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. Andrew writes to us, and I'm assuming is from the UK because he says, my mum. My mum and dad live in Scotland. Their energy bill was $2,000 this year, and it's estimated to be $10,000 for the next year. They are pensioners, but understand that if you give it to a tyrant like Putin, we all suffer more. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I see. What he's saying is I think what he's saying is that despite the cost of forsaking energy from Russia, it's worth the cost in the long run, which is politically what we've all decided. Although we've only decided it to a certain extent, by the way. If he ever used chemical weapons or did something drastic on the battlefield, you would immediately see the U.S. and the EU come out and say, no one can buy energy from Russia, and if you do, we won't do business with you, whatever entity that is. That's called secondary sanctions. So we've been pious in our response, but only so pious thus far. It seems to me that Europe wants to get through this winter, which is going to be difficult, and then I think our piety will increase once spring comes.
We have warned the Russians, have we not?
30 seconds, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just saying this is that lever of if you wanted to be entirely pious, you would pull the secondary sanctions lever. Yeah. We haven't because the political costs would have been too high before we had reorganized affairs. There are things that might lead us to pull it sooner, and I think once we've reorganized our affairs, we eventually will pull it.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll have our last go-around in just a moment. Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Malia DuMont, and Fran Berman. We'll be right back after this news. I don't even care to shake these simple blues, and we don't know just where our boat will rest it us. I guess forgotten and absorbed. You know, this is the great thing about doing announcements like this during the COVID age is that, things start one way and they end another.
So all morning we've been telling you the Darling Side will be performing at UPH, and Cafe Lena will be presenting them tomorrow night. Well, they just postponed the show. So they're not going to be performing tomorrow night, but they're going to come up with a new date. And so if you've been digging the music and you want to see Darling Side, just go to proctors.org, the UPH, or even the Cafe Lena site, and they will hopefully have a date up soon as to what the new date is.
And Joe, that's because COVID is not over.
Tell the president.
Just pointing that out.
Tell the president.
Well, he didn't say that. He said the pandemic was over. I think we are out of the depths of the pandemic.
Well, let's not go there again.
Okay, there we go. I was waiting for you, Fran. All right. Let's go to the story about AI. I think this is a I'm sorry. Go ahead. Mark wanted to make
an announcement.
Joe, a letter writer tried to tag me for tap dancing without any specifics. But after that, a letter writer did specifically mention that when I talk about why the U.S. got on sounder financial footing after Reaganomics, I listed a bunch of factors, and I excluded, which I shouldn't have, the fact that the Fed's constriction of the monetary supply at the time, i.e. Volcker, and the Fed's policy actually was another reason why the economy got back on its feet and inflation was subdued, actually probably the primary reason inflation was subdued. So one letter writer criticized me without evidence. The other one wrote in some evidence and actually did correct my paper, so I'm appreciative for that.
And did they comment on your fastball? Just check them.
All right, so let's talk about this. AI can now create any image in seconds, bringing wonder and danger. This is a front page story in the Washington Post. Basically, they show this array of images, and they are very stark images of, I would say, a school photo of a young child, of a basketball going into a net, of a balloon animal, of a cow, of a dog surfboarding, a bowl full of peppers. And they make the point that none of these are actually taken by a camera. All these images were created by the artificial intelligence text-to-image generator, which is called DALL-E, DALL-E, named for Salvador Dali, and Pixar's WALL-E. DALL-E creates images based on prompts such as a hobbit house designed by, is it Zaha Hadid? Also, a woman in a red coat looking up at the sky in the middle of Times Square. Red and yellow bell peppers in a bowl with a floral pattern on a green rug photo. So you put that in, and bam, you have a picture. Fran, this just made its debut. It's a latest version of DALL-E, which came out in April, and now people are starting to say, oh, well, what does this mean?
Yeah, and it's a really, really good question. This is an incredibly powerful technology. So just briefly on the tech side, you can give it some text, some description, and it will generate images. So that's synthetic media. So I would say an avocado that looks like Alan Chartok. And it will generate a picture that looks like that. And so people are giving it all
kinds of
wacky.
No, seriously, can you do that for us?
I knew. I was watching. You had to be watching Joe's face. Joe's face said it all, which is basically, it already looks like an avocado.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I just think it sounds cool. I think you should just do it. Well, go ahead.
Avocados are pretty great. So it has text to images. It has gotten a lot better lately, and there's two reasons for that. First of all, they're using much more data, and they're using much bigger neural networks. And those models have allowed them to do things at greater detail, and there's a new technique, or not such a new technique, called diffusion models that have really upped the game in photorealism. So if you look at these pictures, and you should go to the Washington Post and look at them, they're kind of amazing. They really look like what we would think of as real pictures, pictures of something we see in life going on. The reason why people are really worried about this is you can do a lot of crazy stuff. You can create what they call deep fakes, which are kind of doctored images or things that are not real but that look real. It reinforces stereotypes. So if you look at these pictures, it isn't necessarily providing the most equitable view of things. There's real worries about porn and victimization. You know, if I say, God forbid, for everybody, a picture of Fran in a bikini and you want to put that out on the internet, you could generate that using AI like that and use it to embarrass me or send it to my children or my employer. I don't think UMass cares, but so you could do things like that. And the problem is, unlike other harmful things in our society, drugs and practices and stuff like that, there are very few social controls. So interestingly, in California and Virginia, there are some social controls about distributing this in inappropriate ways. The companies themselves can put safeguards on it, and that's happened up till now when things are being a little bit more liberally distributed. But right now, there are no federal laws about that. And that's scary because, you know, we will, if there remains that way, which I believe there shouldn't be, we will get to a point where you see something and you don't know what you're seeing. So, you don't know if it's real. You don't know if it's pretend. You know, you don't know if it's a real accurate documentation. You know, we could see pictures of a hurricane in Florida and they could not be there.
So two quick questions about this. One is, if I want to do make up a photo, like, for example, they were talking about the bowl of fruit, and I want to put all of those ingredients in, I want five different colored peppers on a, you know, green background, so forth. How costly is that at this point? Meaning, if I want to do that, does that cost me? Is it cost prohibitive to do that?
That I'm not sure. I am not sure what it costs to use these products. So I don't have a question for, I don't have an answer for that. But my guess is, you go on.
No, I was just going to say, and I would assume like most things, it would probably start off hefty and then get cheaper and then at some point just, you know.
Like, right.
Free, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean.
And this is different from, and I'm sorry, but this is also different from, I mean, we've had versions of this for a long time with Photoshop and so forth.
It's definitely different from Photoshop. Photoshop, you have something that's ostensibly a real photo, or at least something that you want to change. And Photoshop gives you all kinds of ways of doing it. And, you know, one way that Photoshop is used all the time is you can take red eyes. You know, you took a picture and the eyes came out red and you can actually make them a different color. I was talking to a friend yesterday who's learning how to Photoshop, and there's a tree and a background, and Photoshop allows you to cut out the tree and put it on some different background or things like that. But it's a real tree, and somebody's taken a photograph of
right.
it. In this case, everything in that, every pixel in that image has been generated by AI. So it's a pretend picture.
And
this is where the I mean, if you kind of step back, you know, this is happening with the images we see, it's happening with videos, and it's happening with the information we get. You know, in today's world, it is really, really hard to figure out the difference between fake and real. And, you know, in a way you think, well, you know, there should be, you know, some rules and tech companies should be doing it or the government should be doing it. But the fact is, you know, all of us are kind of riding this tsunami of innovation. And it's really hard to see how to control it. And so part of the scary part is there should be some controls either by the companies or the government or both for all of these different and wonderful and innovative technologies, which, by the way, you'll never put the genie back in the bottle. But it's a little hard to see ahead of time how they're going to be used, the downsides, the risks of all of these things. And that's why, especially when you have these technologies that can essentially, and I use this in a very loose way, operate autonomously, and some people think for themselves or learn from experience, you have to be really careful in the way that they're used. And this kind of AI technology, which the article really shows, is becoming better and more prevalent. And I would dare to say, as you point out, Joe, cheaper over time, and less controlled at this point. That's the scary thing. What are we going to do to make sure that it benefits us rather than disadvantages us?
The other thing, Fran, we only have about 2 or 3 minutes left in this, but I thought the creepiest one, like they're all a little creepy, but the one of the kid, the black and white picture of the kid that made it look like an older photograph, and it was so realistic. So where does that come from? I mean, like, who? I know this is stupid, but like, does the computer decide bone structure?
It's not stupid at all, and it's really, by the way, you should ask Jim Hendler the same question. It would be really interesting to see what he has. But what the computer does is it learns on data. So it's gotten images from, you know, essentially everywhere in a very, very large data set. And then, you know, it does kind of what a baby might do. It has a neural model, and it learns by allowing some some things to get through and some things to be discarded at every stage. And the more complicated and the more number of layers that the neural network has, the more sophisticated it can be in figuring that out. But one of the issues around AI is there's a lot of people who think that the AI needs to be more explainable. You need to really be able to explain what an AI program does. On the other hand, you know, if you think about your own learning process, it's pretty hard to kind of explain step by step how you learn the thing you learn.
Right.
And it's pretty hard to explain step by step. You can see sort of perhaps the step the program does, but how that relates to the actual learning is much harder.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning, and I do appreciate it. Alan, thank you very much.
And we appreciate you, Joe.
Mark Whitman, thank you very much for being here. Malia, thank you for making the schlep. I appreciate it. Fran, always good. Sorry for the technical issues in the beginning, but you sound great now, and we'll remember that for the future.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks very much. We'll be right back.